This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and the Biden administration called up another New Englander today, this time Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, Stephanie Pollack, who has served under Republican Governor Charlie Baker since 2015. She will join the Biden administration next Wednesday as Deputy Administrator of the Federal Highway Administration. For more, let's turn to WBUR's Zeninjor Enwemeka. Hi there, Zeninjor.
Hi, Tiziana.
Thanks for joining us. So she's going to D.C. What will she do there? And why do we think she's the one Biden called on?
Yeah, well, Stephanie Pollack will be joining the Federal Highway Administration as a deputy administrator. Now, that agency focuses on the nation's highway system, including everything from construction and maintenance to roadway safety. And Pollack is bringing decades of experience to her new role in the Biden administration. Most visibly, she's been the state's transportation secretary for 6 years, overseeing our roads and highways, as well as the MBTA. And before she was transportation secretary, she worked on transportation policy and did transportation advocacy and research.
Okay, so for those who maybe don't spend all their time paying attention to transportation, let's help people understand her tenure a little bit. She's been one of Governor Baker's most out front cabinet members, served since the beginning of his term. In her time in office, you know, big goals, accomplishments, what can you tell us?
Yeah, she certainly has been one of the more visible members of Baker's cabinet. And part of that is due to the many transportation challenges the state has faced in recent years. Pollack led MassDOT through the historic winter of 2015 when the region was just pounded by snow and the MBTA shut down. And in a statement, Governor Baker praised Pollack for providing MassDOT with stability and leadership over the last 6 years, including during that brutal winter, which we all, I'm sure, remember. And, you know, Baker, And, you know, Baker also noted her leadership on saving the Green Line extension, a project that was delayed and over budget and had to be redesigned and scaled back. Pollack also instituted a data-driven capital improvement plan for the transportation department.
Also, some controversy during her tenures in Indra. Can you remind us of some of that?
Yeah, that's true. There was certainly some controversy, or at least frustration from riders that came along with some of the things I already mentioned, that winter of 2015, the Green Line extension. And Pollack also steered the transportation department through the RMV crisis of 2019. That was when a Massachusetts truck driver struck a group of motorcyclists in New Hampshire and killed 7 people. It turned out the driver should have had his license suspended due to a previous infraction. And that led to a lot of fallout at the RMV.
That really struck me because now we have the relatively new registrar of motor vehicles, Jamie Tesler, taking over as acting secretary in her place. You just talked about the scandal there, which revealed some long-term flaws. Are they stable enough to lose their new leader? And what will Tesler take on as unfinished business in the Department of Transportation?
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting transition, Tiziana, and this does create more leadership turnover at the RMV. Tesler became the registrar after the previous one stepped down during that crisis, and I should note that part of the fallout of the RMV crisis included an internal review and changes to some of their practices. Now, Tesler steps in as acting transportation secretary at a time when transportation has really been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The MBTA faces a massive budget gap due to the pandemic, which has really cut down ridership significantly. And the public transit agency is in the midst of rolling out service cuts across the entire system. There are also major transportation projects already in the works. There's, again, the Green Line extension, and there's the South Coast Rail project. But there are other projects that haven't fully gotten off the ground yet, like the I-90 interchange project in Alston, which has had many delays over the years.
So you're talking about those big projects. Before we let you go, the governor did just sign a $16 billion transportation bond bill. He did veto some parts of it, but it's a big bill, big investments. So what does this transition at the Department of Transportation mean for priorities in that legislation, which just got signed?
Yeah, and it's a big piece of legislation. You're right there. And, you know, the legislation itself does lay out investments for road and bridge maintenance and helps fund some of those major projects I mentioned, South Coast Rail, Green Line Extension. But as you mentioned, Governor Baker vetoed some parts of the bill, including a fee increase on Uber and Lyft and a mandate for the MBTA to offer a low-income fare program. So the legislation and the vetoes sort of gives us a clue as to the priority, at least as Baker sees it anyways. But we'll have to wait and see what the impact of Pollock's departure will be and what a new transportation secretary will do.
Well, WBUR's Zeninjer and Wemeka, sure appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Sure thing.
All right, so now let's talk about the implications of this move with someone who's been in Stephanie Pollock's shoes. Jim Alawisi served as Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation in the Patrick administration, now a board member of the group Transit Matters. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So are you surprised by this choice by the Biden administration? Do you think it's a good thing?
Well, first of all, I think the Biden administration is putting a really good team together. And that's starting from the top with Pete Buttigieg and his deputy, Polly Trottenberg. These are all capable people. I think Stephanie will, as she's always done throughout her career, do well and thrive. She's a very smart and capable person. And I think we wish her well. And I'm really excited about having a federal administration that will begin to care about many of the issues that people like myself and those of us at Transit Matters and other groups have been advocating for a long, long time, mostly focused on a more sustainable way to get people from one place to another in a century that requires more creative thinking, more sustainable mobility, more equity, and more access for people. So it's a good move for Stephanie. I'm glad for her. And now we need to look to the new secretary. But, you know, having been secretary, I can say this. Secretaries largely don't freelance. I did a little freelancing of my own. Didn't really serve me well at the time. But secretaries follow gubernatorial policy when they fulfill their job. That's their role, right? And so when you say, well, will there be changes? Unlikely, unless the Baker administration itself changes its policies, which frankly, in my judgment, increasingly are misguided and are not responding to our needs at this time.
So we'll get to that in a second, Jim. I do want to stay with Pollock for a second. There's a lot in what you just said, and you began by praising the Biden administration for putting this team together, saying it's a good move for her. You also said that, you know, she's following administration policy most of the time. You heard Zeninjer there talk about some really big problems, a crippled MBTA during 2015, during the catastrophic storms, the scandal at the RMV. She's had a lot of sticking power, but she was there through all of that. So is that something where she, I don't know, the she was getting chickens that had come home to roost but were hatched before she got there? Or is any of that laid at her doorstep? And what does that mean for now going to Washington?
Well, you know, the job comes with good and bad. So there are many things that you inherit. She certainly had, you can't lay at the feet of either Governor Baker or Stephanie Pollock, the failure of the T, the meltdown in early 2015. They had just taken office. That was a function of decades of disinvestment. So that's not something you can lay at people's feet. But after a while, you know, longevity in office has its upsides and its downsides. And so after a while, when things do happen, they do tend to sort of roost nearby. But, you know, it's very easy to blame people for things. The reality is that large institutions, whether it's the Registry of Motor Vehicles or the Mass Highway Department or the MBTA, those institutions, problems usually take time to percolate, and they usually percolate over a number of years as a result of things like disinvestment, as a result of neglect. And it's easy, it's convenient to blame whoever is in charge at the time for something happening. But the reality is that the blame, there's many folks to blame, many people to blame, and many years of inactivity to blame. So The blame game, plenty to share in that.
So, Jim, I want to play a little sound from you. This is WBUR's Bob Oakes rode the green line with Stephanie Pollack in 2016. Mm-hmm. And here is what she said about her commute on the T.
I do like my T commute. I've always liked the T. I hate to drive. I guess I'm millennial in that sense. I use the commute to sort of read the papers in the morning and check my emails.
So the T commute becomes a tool.
Yeah, I think if you actually look at the polling on sort of why people like transit, even though the trip is longer, it's because you can do stuff on transit.
So that's really striking. Before that, even before state government, she advocated for car-free public transportation. She's going to the Federal Highway Administration, and as you said, probably not a freelancer. So what does that signal about the priorities of the Biden administration?
Well, you know, the Biden administration's priorities were pretty well laid out by the Secretary-designate Pete Buttigieg in his hearing earlier today. And he was pretty clear right from the get-go that the Biden administration cares about, he didn't use these exact words, but I'll paraphrase, moving more people in fewer vehicles, particularly in urban areas. They care about climate and its connection to transportation sector emissions, which have the largest negative impact on air quality. And so his vision, as he articulated it today, was progressive, was intelligent, and was open to the kind of creative thinking that I'm expecting and hoping he will bring to the job. Secretary Pollack, in her role, will be responding to that leadership. She's not going to be freelancing. And so on the highway side, the president in the campaign talked about wanting to advance new technologies, new energy vehicles. There are places in the country that are not Massachusetts that depend on highway connectivity much more than we do, you know, rural states, mm-hmm. states that don't have urban transit systems. So she'll have a different brief, and I'm sure she'll be able to execute that brief well. Time will tell, but I think most of us are looking forward to a Biden Buttigieg administration transportation policy that will be a 21st century policy.
All right. That is Jim Aloisi, who served as Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation in the Patrick administration and is a board member of the group Transit Matters. Jim, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're nearing the end of phase one of vaccinations in Massachusetts. Governor Baker today opened vaccines to everyone in the phase one category.
We can't move fast enough to vaccinate our residents, and we're building a big vaccination infrastructure to provide convenient, safe, and equitable access to vaccines for every resident in Massachusetts, no matter where you live.
So that's big news for a vaccine rollout that has been criticized as moving too slowly. And that criticism has been especially for communities of color. Just earlier this week, over 400 medical professionals sent a letter calling on Governor Baker to prioritize vaccinations for high-risk communities of color, communities such as Chelsea. So today we're going to hear from two voices on the ground in Chelsea. It was actually a community specifically cited in the letter. Joining us now is Dinanyeli Paulino, the chief operating officer of La Colaborativa, also known as the Chelsea Collaborative. That's a group that works to empower Latinx immigrants to enhance their community's social and economic health. Also joining us is Dr. Wanda Gonzalez, a pediatrician at MGH Chelsea Healthcare Center, who signed the letter. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And listeners, as we talk with our neighbors in Chelsea, we want to hear from you about whether the Commonwealth is getting its priorities in the vaccine rollout right. What phase are you in? Do you think the phases are being established correctly? The governor's made some changes to who's in those phases recently. Are those good decisions? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Dr. Gonzalez, I will start with you. Why did you decide to sign on to this letter?
Well, it seemed like a no-brainer to me, to be honest. I'll quote my husband when we were talking about this. You know, let me start first with saying, you know, I was happy to when I first heard about a huge distribution center in Gillette Stadium. Mm-hmm. But just the, you know, the it makes sense. It's huge. I think they were talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, about 5,000 vaccines a day.
That's the goal. The goal
That's
is to
a goal.
Get to 5,000
That is the goal, indeed. But my concern was its location. You know, for you know, someone like me or my family, well, let's say my family, since I'm a healthcare worker, I get it differently. But, you know, to go to Foxborough to receive it, it's sort of one of those, like, ugh, you know, what a drag to have to drive there. But for my patients in Chelsea, and also I'm also a physician for some people in the surrounding communities, that is quite a barrier. You know, many of them don't have cars, and they also often don't work jobs that have the flexibility to take off, you know, and go over to Foxborough to get their vaccine. And when I was speaking about this with my husband, he said, well, I'm giving credit to him. He said, well, you know, when there's a fire, the fire truck, the fire department comes to the fire. You don't take the fire.
So its proximity is one of the things that you're concerned about then, Dr. Gonzalez, is even if there isn't a vaccine available, it's not very practical if you can't get to it. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
So let me turn then to you, Dean Angeli, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. I practiced it several times before the beginning of the show.
You are. Yes.
Good. So Chelsea Collaborative, La Collaborativa, is directly cited in this letter as an organization that the state could partner with on vaccination, assuming that means to solve the kind of problem Dr. Gonzalez was just talking about. Now, yours is not a medical organization. What role do you think you could fulfill in solving this problem?
Thank you. For helping us amplify this issue. Before I answer your question, I think that we need to understand that Black and Latino population have been disproportionately affected by COVID. Not only are their outcomes as worse, but the economic impact of COVID has also affected them more profoundly. A community impact survey found that a third of Chelsea residents owe rent and are at risk of eviction, and 8 out of 10 residents rely on food assistance. 80% of our population are considered essential workers. Our role as a nonprofit organization, obviously we are not in the medical field, just like we were not in the food industry back in as of March 5th, but we are on the ground. We have the trust of the community. What we asking the larger community and our, our state and local government is that to have a strategy to disseminate information once we have our people are that has been the most affected by COVID, by the disease, also because of the transportation, because, you know, they lived in overcrowding condition, because they have faced underlying health conditions even prior to COVID. What we're asking is that the state and local government should be working with the community members that being on the ground, that have the trust in the community, to have the education campaign. And if we want to make sure to have a recovery plan, we need to make sure that these employees are back to work. And in order for them to do that, in order for them to sustain their families, they need to be vaccinated before they get out of their house.
Okay, so there are several things there. I want to just back up. You made a reference to not being in the food business before the beginning of March. Just for our listeners' sake, I'm assuming you're referring to the fact that the Chelsea Collaborative wound up standing up massive food pantry assistance in the wake of the beginning of the pandemic. Is that correct? That's what you're referring to?
Correct, yes. We did not have a food pantry as part of our core services. We started as a pop-up serving a couple hundreds and became a couple thousand. And right now we're still serving 5 days per week and a food pantry system that, you know, that is, we're still serving Chelsea as a core, community. Yep. But we have people from East Boston, Everett, Malden, Riviera, and even Lynn coming to our food line.
Which underscores your point about the disproportionate impact of the virus.
Absolutely.
Now, so then the other thing that you said, and I'll turn this back to Dr. Gonzalez, you just said, Dean Angeli, that there's still some concern about people being able to get the vaccination, but also the need for a big public education campaign. And Dr. Gonzalez, mm-hmm. we do know that people of color reasonably historically have had suspicion of the medical yeah. community and may be reticent to take this vaccine. When you hear 80% of Chelsea's workers are essential, living in high-density population, what's that education campaign look like that increases people's likelihood of embracing the vaccine?
Is this a question for me or?
Yeah, this is for you.
Yes, okay. Well, you know, I think, you know, Nelly says, you know, made a good point about, you know, we need people in Chelsea who have the trust of the community. So the way I see it, to gain their trust and to educate them about the vaccine and to encourage those who are, are next up for the vaccine to get it, it's really engaging them, I believe, on multiple levels. You know, there is the community-wide level that the Chelsea Collaborative can have. You know, the Chelsea Collaborative has been in the community for years. These are workers that the community knows and trusts. And then there's also the trust that comes from the patient-doctor relationship. You know, myself and many of my colleagues have been working here for years and years. And so I can encourage on more of a micro level, one-on-one, engage my patients. Mm-hmm. I know, it's already coming up, the story of vaccines. So once again, I'm a pediatrician, so my direct patients are not yet in line for vaccines. It has not yet been approved for the majority of my patients. However, as a pediatrician working in Chelsea, I consider the whole family in some ways my patients, and I know a lot about their parents as well. And so when I say my patients, I'm also talking about their parents. And sure. I have already engaged with them in terms of discussion about, well, what is this COVID vaccine? I've had patients come in and immediately tell the secretaries, well, I'm not getting the COVID vaccine. mm-hmm. walking in and already putting up that front when, as you know, it's not yet available as we hope. And so so to gain their trust, it's more on a one-on-one level of people that know, including their pediatricians, our nurses, the medical assistants, to try to explain to them, what are these vaccines that came on so quickly? How can we trust them? How do we know that? I my own methods, and I'm already talking to them about the COVID vaccines because I'm very used to talk about vaccines in general, is I go from a personal level. I'll tell them that, yes, I've received it. As soon as my family's mm-hmm. eligible, they will receive it. So I talk about that. I tell my patients I would not recommend a treatment for you that I wouldn't take myself. And on another level, depending on, what level of engagement I have with the family, I will, basically give them a simple lesson in, basic vaccine, immunology. And okay. I use analogies. I try to make it simple to help them understand.
What would be an analogy, briefly, that you would use?
Okay. I had one I used recently. I addressed it specifically to the two vaccines that are out there currently, the Pfizer and the Moderna. Mm-hmm. As you may mm-hmm. have heard, they're mRNA vaccines, and it's the mRNA is basically the instructions, the specific instructions to make the spike protein. The spike protein, when you see a COVID, a drawing of the COVID germ, the coronavirus.
The ball with all those little spiky things sticking out.
The little spiky things, yes. So what I tell the patients is just think about the coronavirus as being a burglar. And the spike protein is their hand or their arm. And they need that hand to get into your house, right? Mm-hmm. Without the hand, they cannot get into your house. And once they get into your house, the rest of their body does the damage. So I compared mm-hmm. the spike protein to their hand, and I said the vaccine is sort of like, we give you the instructions, we give the house the instructions on how to make a copy of that hand. And the house makes a copy of the hand, figures out the best way to defend against it, but there's no actual burglar in the house, it's just the hand.
Gotcha, right,
and
right.
Then,
and I imagine that does, yes, resonate with people.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I do want to go back to Dina Nyili for a minute. So I want to come back to the letter for just a second because I want to make sure our listeners are clear. As the phases of the vaccine rollout stand right now, beginning in phase two, the governor says that the Commonwealth is reserving 20% of doses from there on out for high-risk communities, or what the letter called hotspot communities. So mm-hmm. it doesn't sound like that you feel like that's enough. Is that a concern about when that 20% is available, the distribution plan isn't there, or is this an argument that 20% of doses needs to be available sooner?
Yeah, and if you allow me to go back to your previous question, I think that we need to be very careful that not to say that Latinos don't want to be vaccinated. I mean, more than 70% of the population in Chelsea are Latinx and/or Latinx immigrant first and second generation. We are used to being vaccinated in our, you know, in the Caribbean and in Central South America. Is that we're talking about the level of the trust level between the community and the government. We have been a community that has been forgotten for decades, and we cannot be, when we're talking about Black and Latinos or Latinx, we need to make sure that we are not putting those two communities as a one strategy. We need to make sure that there are different strategies to what best work for our community. You know, I do not think that it's enough when, you know, or, you know, once again, if you look at the percentage of workers that have lost their job or have their hours being reduced, including the community and the families that are not able to collect unemployment or any type of benefit because they are undocumented, they are in need to immediate need to get out of the home, to put a check on their pocket to make sure that they're able to sustain a roof over their head and a plate on their on the table and to feed their children. This is why I think that we cannot use a profession, and treat everybody, you know, as communities as equal. We need to look this as a region and the region that has been most impacted based on all the underlying conditions that that may affect the families and that particular community. So I do think that that needs to be considered. And when we talk about, you know, having a strategy in a wraparound, you know, culturally competent, you know, information, the community. I'm not talking just about, you know, translating the information into Spanish. I'm talking about, you know, making sure that people are on the ground disseminating this information, that, you know, we collaborate with, you know, we have fantastic hospitals around us that can actually, you know, deploy, you know, outreach workers, healthcare workers to work with us in the community. And once again, it's not just about the vaccine, is one step at making the community healthy again. You know, there are other elements. It's making sure that they have food, they have a house, and they have a job. In order for them to get those three things and to become more dependent, they need to get a vaccine.
All right. We'll look forward to talking with both of you again in the future as we continue to watch how the vaccine rollout goes. That's Dinan Yili Paulino, the Chief Operating Officer of La Colaborativa, and Dr. Wanda Gonzalez, a pediatrician at MGH Chelsea Healthcare Center, who signed the letter this week calling on the Baker administration to step up its prioritization of at-risk communities. Thanks to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy to speak with you. Thank you for having me.
Within hours of taking the oath of office yesterday, President Joe Biden signed a slew of executive actions rolling back policies that had been enacted by the Trump administration. And among them were a number of actions related to immigration. And that includes terminating the so-called Muslim ban implemented in 2017, putting an immediate pause on the construction of the border wall, and a move to safeguard the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. The president also introduced a sweeping immigration bill that would create a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants and provide foreign aid, to several Central American countries. So over the last several years, WBUR has stayed in touch with some young dreamers, enrollees in the DACA program, as they have been buffeted by federal policy changes. And we wanted to check in with them today, given these new actions by the new president. So we welcome back Elias Rosenfeld and Estefany Pineda. Welcome back to Radio Boston to both of you.
Thank you for
having me.
Hello,
thank you.
Great to have you. So, Estefany, we've talked to you a number of times before. What's your reaction to the new president taking these actions, you know, literally hours after his inauguration?
I think it's very hopeful to see that literally hours after being sworn in, that he's already talking about an immigration policy. That does give me hope. But as I have been saying, it's cautious hope. I do I'm very hopeful it's going to get somewhere, but it's also a time to see something more concrete, but I am very happy about it.
And Elias, is it cautious optimism for you too? Is that your reaction?
Yes, I think we have to be cautiously optimistic just because a permanent solution has taken so long to fight to get. But at the same time, I think that it being one of the first executive orders shows the priority this administration has on the issue in comparison to past administrations, as well as a recognition of our labor for the last 4 years in bringing this program to the forefront of the public in this country. And it shows with data and polling that continuously shows that over 80% of Americans across political parties and spectrum support the DACA program. So I think it was common sense for this administration to pass that executive order. And I also think it will foreshadow a centering of immigration policy in Congress in the upcoming months.
So I'll come back to you then, Stephanie. We do know about this sweeping immigration overhaul. It would include an 8-year pathway to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants here in the United States. It safeguards or seeks to safeguard DACA. And that DACA is then expected essentially to turn into a 4-year extension that would bridge through getting immigration legislation passed. What would that mean for your family, for all of that to happen, for you and your family?
It would be, it's not just me in my household that has DACA, as I've spoken about it before. My two older sisters, they also have DACA. And I know TPS is included in there, and my mother has TPS. So it literally affects my entire family. So having something like that, that obviously it's a work in process, and it is going to take 8 years for it to fulfill. But just knowing that gives us peace of mind. And also, to my mother, since TPS is supposed to end in October and she doesn't know what she's going to do, if she's going to be able to work or what's going to happen. So having something like this just allows us to have more peace and to be able to know that I can finish my education and then I can go ahead and look for a long-term job, that my mom can continue working and stay here, because in the past few years, we had even started making plans of going back to El Salvador. So it's just very, it brings a sense of comfort and peace that we hadn't had in the past few years.
And just for our, our listeners, TPS stands for temporary protected status. Elias, I'll turn back to you. You know, one of the things that's striking about this moment is you as a dreamer would live under one America under President Obama. Then here comes President Trump. It's a different America. Now here's Joe Biden, and it's another America again. I think that's hard for people who haven't lived in that whiplash to understand. What has that been like? And are you hopeful that there will be less of that change now?
Yes, definitely. It is a constant pendulum from going from the Obama administration before DACA to then when he passed DACA to then an administration that at every opportunity sought to attack immigrants, being weekends that I had to hide in my apartment when they had announced immigration raids, to now an administration that is very friendly to immigrants. But I think that highlights the necessity for permanent protections, because we cannot live our lives dependent on who is in the White House. We have to have permanent protections that give us a pathway to citizenship, that give us some stability in the only country we call home. And the only way we're going to get that is through legislation in Congress. And so when we talk about the constant kind of emotional wreckage that is the uncertainty of DACA from administration to administration, it sort of highlights the core necessity of why legislation is needed to finally solve this issue that has been in the political scene for over 20 years now.
Stephanie, what do you hope is going to be possible for you now?
I think stability, and my major is international relations, in which I hope to be able to travel for a job. And I had always been fearful of saying I'm studying international relations, because for those who know my status, they're like, well, what's the point if you can't go anywhere? Huh. So even just that little thing, like, well, it seems little, but it's just now it seems like my dreams and like what I want to do as a career, like it's more possible now than it was before.
Yeah, that doesn't seem little. It seems huge. How about for you, Elias?
Yeah, I think it just gives us finally some time to see into the future. For the last 4 years, I think most DACA recipients and undocumented immigrants have really been unable to plan or see their lives ahead of more than maybe a month or so, waiting on court decisions, waiting on the president to tweet about your fate. It's been a constant uncertainty. So I'm looking forward to having some more clarity. For me personally, I'm hoping to go to law school next year. And so having permanent protections means that I'd be able to legally practice the law in every state in this country. And so that to me is very personal because it means I can pursue the career that I've always wanted to. But for me, it's just finally breathing a little easier, not really fearing every morning of what's to come, and also looking forward to finally working on passing policy that uplifts our community versus having to defend the gains that we have had for the last 4 years.
Well, that is Elias Rosenfeld and Estefany Pineda, two local DACA recipients. You guys have been so generous with your stories and your experiences for our listeners and for us at WBUR to understand what you're experiencing. I'm really grateful to you. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to turn now to WBUR's Shannon Dooling, who has reported on immigration policy for a number of years. Shannon, great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing well, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And I am moved, honestly, by what I heard from Estefany and Elias, and I know you heard the conversation. What are your reactions?
Yeah, I think first I would say that, you know, that cautious optimism that we heard them both express is really representative of, I think, you know, many DACA recipients in the community in Massachusetts and throughout the country today. I mean, if you really think about what this community in particular of recipients has been through in the last couple of years, it's been one roller coaster after another. And so while this does offer some, you know, reprieve, I think that that cautious optimism is warranted and understandable.
So what is going to be different for lives of dreamers in the Commonwealth? And how soon will those changes go into effect?
Sure. So, you know, I think when you consider the whiplash, as you referred to it earlier, that this community has experienced, particularly under the Trump administration, you know, years of mixed messages from Trump, all of the court battles, to see that program in writing again, you know, is a sense of relief. It means that new applicants may now pursue DACA protections. That's something that had been on hold for the last few years. And by some estimates, there are 20,000 DACA eligible young people in the state. And so, you know, that's a significant number of people who could have these new protections. I think ultimately, you know, again, as we heard Elias and Estefany say, it's a temporary solution, the way that the program stands right now. This sort of next level remedy, if you will, is what we see in President Biden's proposed legislation, right, which would offer DACA recipients a clear pathway to a green card and citizenship. And that's something that the original program, even established under Obama, did not do.
Yes. So, you know, to that end, we've talked about the whiplash, the changes from administration to administration. For years, the country has been lamenting that a real immigration reform bill has not been passable in the U.S. Congress. So, you know, I want to ask how feasible the immigration overhaul that the new administration wants actually is.
Right. I mean, it's ambitious. You know, it's ambitious, but Biden had to do it, and he had to do it early. In the administration after making the promises that he made on the campaign trail. And I remember speaking with a lot of folks who were, you know, immigration advocates and people in the community who were are ready to hold him accountable for those promises. So I think with the Democratic majority in the Senate, there's perhaps a sense of optimism on behalf of the stakeholders, advocates, of course, we know. They've been here before, though, you know, on the cusp of large scale immigration reform under Obama, only to have that falter. So I think we see Biden, you know, smartly, I would say, trying to first rebuild some of the trust in these communities with, you know, these executive orders. But the real meaningful structural change that so many immigrant communities have been working for, I mean, we'll have to see if Biden can sell it to some of his colleagues on the right, or even perhaps, you know, fold some of this into economic recovery plans.
So, you know, you actually introduced us here at Radio Boston to Estefany. You followed her for a number of years now. You followed U.S. immigration policy under Presidents Obama, Trump, now Biden. What has it been like to document, you know, these different approaches to DACA, to immigration policy, and to see firsthand how it has affected people like Elias and Estefany?
Yeah, it's been a trip for the last couple of years. I can admit that. I mean, I think first I would say, you know, even with the complete upheaval of immigration policy that we saw under Trump, which, you know, seemed to happen overnight, just like this change under now President Biden has changed overnight. You know, fewer people were deported under Trump than were deported during the first term of the Obama administration. I think that's something we need to keep in mind here. I mean, we've heard this moniker from immigration advocates referring to Obama as deporter in chief. You know, a lot of that has to do with different enforcement priorities early on in the Obama administration. You know, he, of course, pivoted during the second term and started to focus on felons, not families, was his catchphrase, similar to the priorities that President Biden has laid out. You know, those enforcement priorities shifted when Trump was elected, and suddenly anyone in the country without legal documentation was a target for deportation. And we heard Estefany and Elias talk about the stress that that caused.
So we have a little more than a minute left, Shannon, and I want to ask, is this just a return now? So Joe Biden was vice president under Barack Obama. Is this a return to an Obama era set of policies, or is Joe Biden really exploring new territory here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's worth emphasizing the drastic difference between the Trump priorities and what we're seeing so far in these first 2 days from Biden. Tremendous amount of fear within immigrant communities, a tremendous amount of stress, this constant unknowing of whether your family member was going to come back from work. To an extent, there's a reprieve from that now with Biden's new enforcement priorities. When we look beyond the executive orders to Biden's proposed immigration reform, I think that's where we see the really significant proposals, right? A pathway for citizenship for DACA recipients.
10 seconds.
Yeah, 11 million undocumented residents living in the U.S. who could have access to citizenship. It's significant. It's substantial.
Well, WBUR Shannon Dooling. Shannon, I appreciate you giving us the analysis. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yesterday's inauguration was just so different. No cheering crowds, no standing elbow to elbow, you know, in D.C. joyously celebrating history being made. Despite that, most of us had to watch it from afar on TV or online, there were actually some moments that took our collective breath away. And one of those was provided by Amanda Gorman, who read her poem, The Hill We Climb. Here's a bit of that.
Being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated.
So 3 years ago, Amanda Gorman joined us right here on Radio Boston, and we thought we'd close our show today by revisiting part of that conversation. So this is inaugural poet Amanda Gorman, then just an 18-year-old Harvard student, talking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty in February of 2018 about when she first fell in love with poetry.
In third grade, I was 8. My teacher, Shelley Fredman, was reading Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury, and there was a metaphor in there that blew my mind. I ran home, and I was like, I want to be a writer, straight to my mom. And she was like, wow, great that you know that so soon. But that was a really magical moment for me.
Wow, okay. And you have a poem that's named Dandelion Wine.
Yes.
Okay. So clearly the inspiration was deep there. Can you read a little bit of that poem?
I would love to. I'll read a quick excerpt from that. Our people have met centuries with their bodies entombed under the coastline of a ribcage, pelvic shore. Below waves, they shrine our bodies in Vaseline to breathe quiet into our pores. Homi nila kou, homi nila kou, hecked the crows, the sound chasing the stars. We have a saying, vide neyungu vasila obona. Don't shoot, brown trees put their hands up, afraid of death, but more so life. You see, branches and roots are the same. I found trunks don't rise. They're just wise enough to fall into the sky. Away, away, we are grounded in the absence of ground. We be free, be poet, we be poet tree, be poetry. Hominila ko'u, we sing, splitting open the sky as light unfolds back into our mouths.
Hmm. That is Dandelion Wine, read by Amanda Gorman. It's her original poem. She is the U.S. Youth Poet Laureate. Beautiful. Really.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit more about, since you did mention the Ray Bradbury, was this poem directly inspired by that? Is there a link between the two?
There are so many threads in this poem. It was one, thinking about my connection with poetry, obviously, but also partly thinking about sound and my struggle with a speech impediment, which got me writing in the first place, and also trying to tie that to my heritage in the African diaspora. Yeah. So there's just a networks of threads going in there. So definitely it being named Dandelion Wine is kind of an homage to that original inspiration.
Yeah. I mean, so talk to me more then about, as you said, talking about the story of the African diaspora, mm-hmm. through your poetry. Mm-hmm. How important has that been in terms of the verse that you choose to, that you write?
Mm. It's been critical for me. When I started writing, it was a lot from reading a lot of stories that didn't reflect characters that looked and or sounded like me. And then I got to this kind of post-Toni Morrison phase where I read The Bluest Eye, and I realized it was possible to have prose and poetry and fiction that centered around a Black girl, and that was very exhilarating for me. So now whenever I write poetry, the thought is kind of, who is being left out of the literature and how can I include that in my own poetics.
Mm, okay. So does that mean that poetry has always been very political for you?
Yes. And I also say that I think that everything is political. So that's an interesting topic for me. My poetry is political, but I think all art is political in its own shape and form.
So what do you think that poetry, is there a particular thing that poetry can do in terms of being a political voice that maybe other art forms, I won't say can't do, but mm-hmm. poetry does it differently,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
because
definitely.
words are mm-hmm. what make the poem.
Mm-hmm. I think that poetry does a very fantastic and special job in teaching us the power of words over violence, and also about how to use kind of the potential of language to create social change. Specifically, poetry compared to, for example, prose, because poetry is already rebellious. When I'm writing a poem, I know I don't have to stick to specific grammar rules. It's okay if my line breaks here. I'm automatically kind of in my own resistance of the traditions of the literary form, which I think is very kind of magical about the work of poetry that it does.
Yeah.
That was inaugural poet Amanda Gorman speaking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty right here on Radio Boston back in February of 2018. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi, me, Tiziana Deering, you, great listeners, thanks. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.